Hello, everybody. It's been a while, but welcome back to Enclave. Have a really good show for you today with my good friend Stephen Boyer. Stephen and I met bizarrely when he was going to college in downtown Los Angeles, and I was hired to do a series of short films, which we then were supported by the school he was going to at the time, and we became friends. And then he would go on to be my second AD on a lot of projects, edit stuff for me, as well as just be a, generally, a professional friend. There's been many nights where we have gone and we have waxed and discussed all the different things that are happening, and basically the show that you get to see tonight is the two of us just kind of going at it as we normally do. He's a wonderful guy. He's become a professional editor, and does tons of stuff. I'll have stuff in the links for you to check out. If there was ever a glimmer of hope, it's Stephen Boyer. He is just a fantastic person. This was recorded, God, I guess now a few months ago. There's been so much that has happened since the last time I got an episode out with a guest. We're still in COVID times. We've got a couple new developments to add to the list amidst murder hornets and UFO sightings, or I guess UFO confirmations from the federal government. I guess we also now have an amoeba in Florida that attaches to your brain, and the president is talking about not obeying the laws of the land in terms of elections. He's not going to respect the election and step down. It's been kind of a kooky time, I guess. So please forgive the long wait, but I'm glad that the audience space is growing. So happy that people have responded to some of the earlier episodes. So just sit back and if you have anything that you'd like to mention in the comments or reach out to me, please do. You're more than welcome to. Yeah, let's get this next episode of Enclave going.
Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Bowman.
Stephen, why don't you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what you do?
Yeah, so I'm a video editor, and a video editor does many things. I guess what I like to think I do is, help package material, help sell movies and television shows and products in a
Right.
way that is engaging, right? I mean, that's the thing. I think that we're really, really, really bombarded. And we, the average American sees hundreds and hundreds of ads a day, just in a single day. And so I like to think that me and the people I work with try to make it not so noisy, I think is my real creative goal in it. But, it's ultimately a lot of it is sales, and when I get to work on an indie film or something or someone's short, I really do enjoy it and I really love it.
Cool. Well, what's some of the stuff you've been working on recently?
Yeah, so I guess I could talk. I've been doing these modern trailers for HBO Max.
Cool.
So like repackaging. It's really fun. So like one that is out that is public now is we took the trailer for Casablanca and then recut the movie. We took the film and we recut it as if it was a movie that was coming out in 2020. And so the only direction was like, okay, like you're on the marketing team for this movie. This movie's going to come out in theaters this year. How would you sell it? And so obviously the way you edit a trailer in 2020 is like way different than 1943.
Yeah, no, for sure. I'll be sure. I can link that, right? That's okay.
Oh yeah, that one's out. That one's public. But
Cool.
there's some ones coming up that are really cool. There's a lot of like classics that I know people are going to be excited about, which is fun.
That's cool. I guess Warner Brothers is like opening their library up to HBO Max and just putting everything.
Yeah, it's
That's
crazy.
cool.
It's I don't say this just because I like work for them right now, but like HBO Max is pretty insane. The amount of content that is in this one service. It's all of Warner's and HBO and Crunchyroll and Studio Ghibli and Turner Classics. And
I did not know Studio Ghibli was on there. That's awesome.
It's the first time they've been on a service. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Huh. You know, it's interesting with the like, obviously there was a huge pivot toward streaming content, like probably, I'd say 2 years ago, that's when everybody started kind of like realizing they needed their own streaming service.
Yeah.
It is interesting to see how Warner Brothers is going to compete against, I mean, the two big fish in the pond, right, are Disney and Warner Brothers. So.
Well, Netflix.
Netflix, right. But they don't have, I don't know.
They don't have the backlog of IP. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And it'll be interesting to see how they all function together. Like I see HBO through Amazon, right? But I guess by that measure, Amazon too. They're a pretty interesting studio in and of themselves. But
yeah,
But I don't see myself like getting Peacock, for example, right? Or
yeah, I think the thing is that a lot of these services. You know, they have to, I think to have the draw, you know, you have to have something that is like, is nostalgic and new. It has to be both. You know, I think that I think people's viewing is really like, it's got to have kind of both. Cause you have to target people who want to just obviously like watch reruns of their favorite sitcom.
Right.
But then, you know, there is a lot of people who also want, you know, new and original
right.
programming that is like modern and interesting and edgy and scary. And, you know, I think it's really hard. I mean, I think about this all the time with just tone and everything I do is like finding the balance between just like straight up spoon feeding you sugar as a viewer. And then also like, but here's like a lesson that we're trying to like Trojan horse into here somewhere. And that balance is, I think, even the smartest, most intelligent storytellers I know struggle with like commercial versus actually having like a point, you know?
Right. Well, I mean, I feel as though it's also a matter of, you know, you have all of these different studios and production companies and they all don't want to be the only person carrying the water, you know? So it doesn't matter. I think these days it doesn't matter what theatrical movie you see, there's like at least four production companies that are involved with it.
Yes.
And so I do think that that means that the message has to be really vanilla, right? Like yeah. divorce is sad. And yes. I just saw, what was the movie?
War is difficult. Yeah.
War is difficult. And, you know, Will Smith has kind eyes. Like that's you know, versus kind of that, like, I mean, you're always comparing the present to the past, you know, versus movies used to be really like a plot twist, you know, Mel Gibson, or not Mel Gibson, excuse me, Harrison Ford in, what was that great thriller that he was in? But he plays this doctor, and he's actually the serial, he's kind of a serial killer. You know, who would ever think that Harrison Ford is a serial killer? He's like, you know, America's dad.
Yeah. I feel like that's just kind of features though. Cause I feel like, I don't know, there's like some really interesting, complicated themes happening in TV because of the runtime.
Oh no. Television. Yeah. In terms of television, weirdly, television still hasn't adopted that. Like it'll have maybe two production companies that make it and then the distributor.
Yeah.
Or they just buy you out outright, and they don't want, you know, they don't want to have the noise of other production companies. But that's why I think that television, you know, it allows itself to be so, let's use the word edgy, right?
Like yeah. The most daring stuff I've seen in the last couple of years was definitely like TV shows for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. It's unfortunate because that used to be the realm of movies, you know? I think it's almost impossible to make a movie that can be edgy these days because you've got to not only satisfy the broadest audience, you also have to satisfy the executives and producers of, you know, five, six different production companies, which just, I don't think is possible.
Yeah, it's really hard. And this is an interesting question. And I actually want to fully attribute this idea and this question to a friend of mine named Tony Gross, who wrote a cool little article on this. But like his thing is like, what is a movie? Like if I just binge Chernobyl for 6 hours, that's kind of a movie. If I watch the last, you know, I watched all 7 episodes of Ryan Murphy's show, Hollywood. I watched it in a day. And like in my mind, that's just like a feature I watched, you know, like does it really matter? I don't know.
I think, you know, I mean, I guess officially, right. There's always an association of length, right?
Yeah, like a 79 feature, minutes. Yes.
Right. Otherwise it's a short, you know, and I've seen 45 minute shorts and it's very unusual. Like, why don't you just add a little bit more time? You could be a feature. But I guess to answer your friend's question without having read his article, and I will, and I'll post it, I would say that there is something to do with length. Like a feature has a pocket of time where you have to have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and you have to be able to consume that story in a sitting, right?
Yeah.
Like, binge watching is kind of like a phenomenon that I think people aren't, like everybody binge watched for like a year, and now people are not binge watching as much, right? Like they're HBO still releases things on a week by week basis, and people have started, like, especially during the quarantine, like they don't just sit and watch 8 hours. They try to parcel it out over the course of the week. Otherwise, you don't have anything to watch. So
yeah.
So I think that a movie is still a story that has to be told over the course of a single like sitting. I think the movies that are like 4 hours long, I think that's kind of
crazy. I just watched one of those actually.
Yeah, wasn't The Irishman 4 hours long?
I haven't seen that one. I just watched Andrei Rublev, which is 3.5 hours, and I watched it in one go, and it was. Yeah. Super intense. I mean, like by the end of it, I was exhausted.
Yeah, and there are movies that stretch to that length, but But again, I think a television show, you know, which roughly has, I mean, with the exception of things like Sherlock, which I think has 2 hour episodes, generally speaking, is 55 minutes or something like that.
Yeah. So I want to counter this. I think that for me, a movie is really just about the ending. And you and I talk a lot about, you told me once, many years ago, you said, the mastery of storytelling comes in the third act. Mm. And I don't know if you thought about that when you said it, but it always stuck with me because I really do feel like why I gravitate, like when I sit down at the end of my day or whatever to watch something, the reason I usually pick a film is at least I know it's going to end. Mm. Whereas I feel like a television show, unless I just know it's going to be such a great premise or something, I feel like I'm just always kind of, it's like I'm being led on or something.
Right. And well, you are, right?
Yeah. And there's been a lot of really long shows that I've gotten into for multiple seasons where they got to the end and was like, it was really disappointing. And I know that with a movie, like generally most films that are like highly regarded and well respected usually have really great endings, and the endings are a huge component of why they're good. And I feel like, you know, I like Marvel movies and stuff like that, but I don't need to watch anymore after like Endgame, you know, because like it just felt like, oh, okay, that's the end of this. Like I don't need any more, you know.
Right.
And I feel like with TV, I worry, I guess, sometimes that it's just a thing we consume just to consume. Whereas I feel like with like movies, I mean, some of them are silly, most of them are, but the ones that are really great, you know, there's a point to them. And I feel like kind of goes back to what like we're talking about at the beginning. Like, I just want there to be a point to the stuff we take in, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, so one of my, you know, one of the storytellers that I've always enjoyed their stuff, regardless of the fact that he's kind of a terrible person, at least in the things he believed, was H.P. Lovecraft, right? And H.P. Lovecraft inspired all, you know, many, many filmmakers as well as storytellers, Stephen King being one of them, and basically created this notion of eldritch horror, which was kind of a horror before we knew what how like physics worked. So in H.P. Lovecraft's universe, the, you know, space is a dark ocean, you know, because we didn't have any rockets to go up there and find out what it actually was. So in the turn of the century, he's kind of creating this content, and which is highly regarded. And, you know, there were a lot of people that then based their own writing off of his stuff. But ultimately, he was writing for the word, right? Like, he was he was getting to 500, 1,000, 8,000 word counts. So once he gets to the end, it just kind of, it very typically just drops off. It's like, and done. Like,
it doesn't end, it stops.
Yeah. Right, exactly. And I feel that television, in a lot of ways, which is actually why I think that miniseries are going through a really interesting resurgence. I don't know if you just watched Mrs. America.
No, I want to. It looks really interesting.
It's phenomenal. Yeah. But basically, that television suffers from that same motivation. It's like, we have to get to 8 episodes this season, and we have to get to 10 episodes, or whatever the count is. And then we have to be renewed for another season. So we have to give people enough that they get, you know, they have the water cooler conversation of like, oh my God, you see the season finale for The Office or something, right? I can't wait for the next season, you know. And then that motivates you, that motivates the executives to green light another season. Versus a movie, which I mean, every movie wants a sequel, right?
I guess. I mean, I don't know. Like,
at least, like, we're getting Top Gun 2. Right.
Sure.
Like, we're getting.
Yeah. Like, does Arrival want a sequel? I don't know. Maybe not. I was actually about to say, like, does 2001 want a sequel? And then I just realized, like, oh no, like, there is a sequel.
There is a sequel. Yeah. No. I mean, like, movies, by their very nature, like, especially successful movies, like, of course, you know, people want to revisit a character, and even when they shouldn't. Like, I think Matrix 1 was incredible. It's probably one of the best movie. I'll say it's in at least my top 20. Right.
I love that film.
Like, and it influenced everything from like cell phones to glasses, you know, like everybody was fashion, a hacker.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, like, I mean, it was such a huge movie. And then the second one came out, and then the third one came out. And now, I don't know, like was its impact, would it have had a greater impact if it was just one film? You know, versus kind of, I mean, it certainly made Warner Brothers, you know, and all the people involved gobs of money. But, and the same thing can be, I think, can almost be said for almost every franchise film series. Yeah. Like, you get one really awesome one, and then it's kind of like, now they're trying to milk it a little bit. And whenever I think the motivation is milking, I think you just get a kind of a, not as pure a product. You know?
Yeah, and that's I go back to that debate constantly. It's so difficult because, I mean, I work, you know, 90% of my work is advertising. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's a very tough thing. And it's I mean, anyone who's been a creative on someone else's payroll can relate to this, of just like, you have this kernel of like, oh, this could be really cool and we could do it this way. But you're also trying to balance like, yeah, but we still have to like, you know, sell a cheeseburger.
Right.
And that debate is ongoing. And I don't know if there is an answer to that. But
it's art, right? I mean, and it's just ultimately subjective. Unfortunately, it's the same kind of argument that you can make for like big game hunting, right? Like, I get a license, I pay $1,500 to shoot a rare endangered animal, but then that $1,500 goes toward conserving the rest of the park, right?
Yeah, it's kind of complicated. I was gonna say this exact thing is why I am one of, you know, the 12 people in the world that still like really loves like self-funded narrative short films, people doing stuff with their own money and not answering to anybody. I think that like it's unimaginably rare in these days to be able to like be at least a filmmaker and, you know, be able to make any kind of project, even if it's 5 minutes, and not have to like not have to take somebody's notes, like not have to report to a studio, not have an agenda.
Right.
Certainly musicians and painters and photographers can do that, but film is so inherently tied to a lot of other people just to do it. And
sure,
so,
but I mean, yeah, everybody's always looking for the next pay. I mean, ultimately, we're a capitalist society, right? Nobody takes care of us, right? There's no film funds, really, so to speak, in this country. There are in other countries, right?
Yeah, it's true.
No one's going to help feed you, and you're going to have to pay for your own health care. So the notion that like you can just be an artist is I don't think has ever really been an American trait of American filmmakers or artists. Like you're ultimately looking for someone to feed you, right? To pay the bills. And that's one of the reasons why I think we have such incredible artists, because it's desperation, right? I mean, Jaws is probably the best example of that, where they really wanted this animatronic shark to work. But when they were looking over the footage in post, I mean, very famously, I won't attribute it to just the editor, but that room of people determined, we just can't see the shark, you know? And I bet you if that movie had been made in like Italy or Germany or even England, you would have seen the big fake animatronic shark. Because that's what they really want. They wanted it to work, and they weren't really beholden to sales, right? Mm-hmm. And maybe the same thing can be said for, you know, Star Wars. George Lucas, I think his first cut of New Hope was something like 3.5 hours.
Yeah,
right?
It's famously pretty tough to watch, apparently.
Right. And I think Steven Spielberg then introduced him to John Williams, who then, you know, kind of took the score over. And they that notion of collaboration is I'd like to think is because of, you know, wanting to make the best product. Mm-hmm. But making the best product is ultimately so you make the most money, right?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting idea that you're talking about, because I'm such a like purist in many ways, and so sometimes I will overthink things and just be like, well, you know, it's just there can't be any financial incentive for it to be. But I know that that's super naive.
I wouldn't say it's naive. It's more
unrealistic.
yeah, but I mean, like, whatever a nice way of saying unrealistic is, like, it's very
cool.
You know, yeah, of course, I don't want I don't want to have like somebody tell me that I have to lose 5 minutes so that we can add 5 minutes of some kind of product placement. You know, of course I don't want that. But and I think, you know, Christopher Nolan went through this. You know, the myth around the last Batman movie was that he was going to kill Batman. You know, Batman dies in the nuclear explosion, saving the city, and that makes for a better story. But the myth is that an executive came down from on high and said, you can't kill Batman, you know?
That's an interesting notion that you're bringing up, though, that like perhaps because the art is made for survival, I don't know if better is the word, but it makes it we're more critical about it. And maybe that's good. I don't know. That's interesting.
I don't know. I mean, it definitely there hasn't been in the 100 years of filmmaking that we've got, 110 years of filmmaking that we have. I don't think that any other country has done as good a job as the United States when it comes to entertainment factor, you know?
Yeah. Entertainment. We're super great. I don't know if we can say the same about like, you know, how much we've revolutionized or like changed the art form, but like, you know, in an academic sense, but definitely in terms of entertainment and exports, our exports
right.
Crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I would be hard pressed to find a more noticeable export. I mean, maybe we export oil now that we've like opened up more sand field, but like who cares about oil? Like in terms of like global cultural impact,
I'd
say film is if you, what is it? Somebody said like, if you talk to an alien based entirely on like signals that they picked up from our you know, satellites and entertainment, right, they would think that British people are 50% of the population.
Yeah. Well, that's a representation issue, but yeah, I hear what you're saying. Yeah.
Right. I'm not saying it's necessarily a good thing, but it's just,
no, they would absolutely think that. And they'd also think that like wow, we should really target New York. Like that's because right. that's in all the movies. Yeah.
Yeah, no, exactly. Like when something happens on planet Earth, it happens in America.
Yes, in American movies, certainly. Yeah.
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 And that's one of the reasons why it's so important to, I think that especially since the internet really became mainstream about 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I would say that everyone has now realized you need to produce narrative content. Like as a culture, you need to be mm-hmm. able to, because it represents tourism, right?
Yeah.
It represents people's comfortability of like working. Like if we've all seen Endgame, right?
Yeah.
On the planet Earth, you can talk to anybody. You don't even really need to speak the language, right? You can talk about that movie. You can gesture furiously or draw pictures, but you have a common ground, and then that common ground is an American-made movie.
It's pretty crazy. I remember walking out of Endgame and I like overheard a conversation between these two guys who clearly had never met each other, but mm-hmm. they were just gushing about the movie and like these, I don't know, but these like two extremely like clearly very like closed off masculine dudes, but they were just like, sure. they made friends because of that film. It was kind of sweet. I don't know.
Yeah, no. I know how important sweetness is to you.
Let's clarify that.
In the wild talking about Endgame.
let's clarify that. I'm a sucker for anything that is heartfelt or sentimental, but earned. I don't just like schmaltz, man. Schmaltz? I can't get into Hallmark movies.
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
That's interesting. You would think that, I haven't seen a Hallmark movie in a very long time. When I was working at a production company, they were trying to get in on Hallmark's kind of like reinvention of themselves, which, you know, I shortly left thereafter, so I don't know how that went. But I don't know. I mean, Hallmark does. It's interesting how Hallmark does just it checks off all the boxes, right? You have a sweetheart type of girl that is from a small town. She goes to the big city. I think she meets a prince usually, and then she has to go back to the small town, or the small town comes to her, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's. I guess the structure is kind of nice. I don't know. I like it when it's like sweet at the very end, you know, and like the movie's really hard to get through, but then there's like a hopeful ending. I like that kind of thing.
So 1917.
1917 got me, man. Yeah, yep. I thought that was great. Yeah.
No, I know. So at the very end, cracks open the little like keepsake and oh, that's why he is who he is. No, I understand what you're saying. I guess I like the very opposite in terms of, like, I like the Usual Suspects ending where, he was Kaiser Soze the whole time, you know? And
I like that stuff, too. Like, I think it changes. Like, certainly 4 years ago, I was way more of a sentimentalist than I am now. But, you know, like, I still like crazy, weird, challenging endings that are, like, dystopian, you know. It's a balance. Like I feel like I can, like just this week I watched like some really really tough films, and then like last night I was like, I gotta watch like WALL-E. I watched WALL-E because I can't live in the darkness perpetually. I don't know.
No. And I definitely think over the course of our relationship I have now realized the value of the happy ending.
Yeah, man.
I just want the happy ending to be earned.
I'm with you. I want it to be. I don't like fake happy. I think if the movie is 90% suffering and then 10% hope at the end, I actually think that can be really powerful. You know?
Yeah. I would say there's the one of the best examples of that I can think of is Aliens. You know?
Yeah.
Where no one's listening to her. They decide to launch a mission because they realize they should have listened to her. She gets out there. She's still like, she's trying really hard to be helpful to the Marines, right? But she's not a soldier. Mm. But she's also been in the situation before. So she has this really interesting firsthand account of how bad these monsters are. And nobody realizes it until, you know, all hell breaks loose. And I think like two thirds of the Marines get wiped out in a single engagement. Right. And then it's a fight for survival. And then finally at the end, she's saved the little girl who that reflects back on the fact that she lost her daughter because she, you know,
right.
She was in stasis, but her daughter died of old age. Anyway.
No, there's a wound. That's
right. Like, exactly. Yeah. And no, and it just, it all, I mean, I would say that Aliens is a really great movie that incorporates then she finally, you know, she rises to the occasion, and it's not just, she picks up a gun and is able to, you know, chain kill her way to freedom. she gets into that giant suit, which we established earlier on that she's actually a really good operator of them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And if anybody could get into that suit and fight a giant alien queen, it's her. So I like it. I like it when all the threads made sense and everything coalesces at the end. And you do get, I mean, she crawls into the cryo tube with the girl and the android survives. Right. And then the third movie kind of turned all of that into sadness again. But
I've actually only seen the first two ever. Cause you know, everyone just speaks so negatively about 3 and 4. I just never bothered.
It's Guillermo del Toro and, oh no.
Was it?
Guillermo del Toro.
No, it's Jean-Pierre Winnet is an Amelie guy, right?
Yeah. Did the third one and Guillermo del Toro did the fourth one.
Or was it? I thought David Fincher did one.
Was it? You know what? Maybe
someone is listening to this and getting really frustrated. I know.
Here, tell you what. Just for the sake of, I don't normally like to cheat and use the internet, right?
No, but it's okay.
I will do it. Okay, so Winona Ryder was in it. Sigourney Weaver. It was 1997, and you're right. Jean-Pierre Jeunet. Who was Guillermo del Toro the writer? I was almost positive he was involved. No, written by Joss Whedon. Wow.
Oh, interesting.
That's
also had a hand in Toy Story, which I always found interesting.
Yeah, isn't that cool?
Yeah, super cool.
Yeah. No. Yeah, I don't know why I thought that. Once again, you're right. Somebody's listening and knows exactly.
And just pulling their hair out. You know, another just like random bit of like, oh, that person worked on that I always found interesting is, do you know who shot the movie The Cat in the Hat?
No, wait, the live.
Yes, the live action film.
I've never seen it, but who?
Emmanuel Lubezki, Chivo, 3-time Academy Award winner, shot that movie.
Well, you know what? It's Cat in the Hat.
Yeah, no, I don't like fault him for it. I just, it's such a like funny, like you look at that man's career of like the most boundary pushing genre, like intense, dark, crazy stuff. And then it's like, oh yeah, he also shot this like kids movie in 2005. It's crazy.
I mean, it's like when you find out that John, I like the fact that John Williams wrote the score for Home Alone, you know, which is, you know, just a couple shades above what you would think a Hallmark film is, right? Like, oh, yeah. Plucky young kid gets left home alone. You know, like you can see how it could have almost gone in that direction.
Yeah, he also did the music for the Olympics, which is pretty crazy.
That's insane.
Yeah,
that's insane. Yeah, no, I like it when people genre. I guess everybody kind of does it.
Oh, I love it. I do not subscribe to the idea that anyone is one kind of thing.
Oh, I agree.
A lot of people say like, oh, Hollywood hates hyphenates, but I don't know. I think that it's really cool when you see like an actor who's been a great actor for a long time direct a film and it's really interesting, or you know, an editor make the jump to directing. I mean, I don't know. These things are, that's exciting. You know, it shows growth.
But you know what? It's an unfortunate aspect of what we were talking about before. The reason why Hollywood doesn't believe in it, or producers or financiers are wary of it, is can you make the jump? And if you don't make the jump, you're going to cost us a lot of money, right? And that's an unfortunate, I don't agree with that. I think that that's a really unfortunate stigma, and it's related directly to the notion of, you know, financial success. I think if a movie makes its money back, it's a financial success, because that means that, you know, everybody got their investment back. Everything after that is going to be profit, right?
Well, and everyone that worked on it was employed for however many months, and yeah.
Right. I think that the mistake is when, you know, a movie that, you know, it has to make, I hate it, but it has to make $100 million over what the investment was. Like, and that's,
yeah,
that's, I mean, so crippling. You know,
I've heard about films, you know, made by studios where the film made $1 billion, and you'd have a friend and I'd be like, wow, that's crazy that you worked on that and it made so much money. And they're like, oh yeah, the studio actually thinks that it's technically a failure, even though it made $1 billion, because they were expecting $1.25 billion. It's like, dude, what? Movie made $1 billion. How is that a failure? That's crazy.
Yeah. No, it's bizarre. And that's because, I mean, you know, it's a multi-tiered corporation, right?
Yeah.
Its entertainment division has to make X amount of dollars in order to make the rest of the machine happy. And that's why I'm kind of really hopeful for Netflix and Amazon, because they're entirely like, well, with Amazon, their entertainment branch is just to get you to go to the Amazon homepage, right? Like, that's, if you look at, by and large, the job of Amazon Entertainment or Amazon Studios, excuse me, is to hopefully get you to have a subscription, right, to the rest of it. And then, wow, look, I could also get Whole Foods. And, oh, what's this? I could, you know, order, like, this obscure book that I haven't, you know, that I've been wanting to read. You know, things like, it's just a driving force behind that. And with Netflix, they're in it entirely for subscription-based entertainment. The only thing they're beholden to is making sure you stick around.
Yeah, they look at themselves as a tech company that, you know, they don't look at themselves as a studio, and they just want you to keep subscribing. And my understanding is that Netflix doesn't even, like, they have development people, obviously, but that you really have to come to them with, like, a fully packaged deal before they'll even, like, talk to you, which, you know, I get it. They just probably, I mean, they have zillions of people approaching them every hour, I'd imagine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no. I totally, totally agree. And I've heard that as well, that, you know, treat them like you would any production company. You know, you've got this, this, and this.
Yeah.
You know, okay, great. You know, and then they'll make it happen. And the good, for another thing I've heard about them is that they don't care what you make as long as you deliver what you promised, right?
I've heard similar things, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's... versus what the studio, I mean,
The studio system is we're going to committee, you know, we're going to review and committee and watch all your dailies, and we're going to have a lot of eyes on it constantly.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's one of the reasons that Joss Whedon stopped making Marvel movies, you know? Once again, the mythology and rumor mill that is Hollywood, that's what I hear, you know?
Yeah. I don't know. I try not to read too much into that stuff, but, you know, I understand anyone that like I, without getting too specific, I have known and grown up around a lot of people who have worked at extremely high levels of studio filmmaking, and it's really difficult. And it's the kind of thing where you just have to, like, oh, you're going to be working on that one little thing. Okay, I'm going to give up the next, you know, 2 weeks and not see anybody to go, like,
right,
perfect this one thing, you know, this one 2 minute part of the movie.
Right.
And that, you know, I don't fault anybody who doesn't, like, who gets out of that. I also, it's the same reason, like, when I have friends who tell me, like, oh, I kind of want to get out of LA, like, I'm kind of sick of it. Like, I don't make the argument for them to stay, because it's like, this is really, really hard. And it's not, like, unless you have to be very, very strong mentally to do any of this stuff, especially at the higher levels, especially at studio levels. And so, like, yeah, I get it. Like, it's really, really tough.
Right.
And so I don't fault any filmmaker for, like, I think we always want filmmakers, like, as an audience to, like, get bigger and bigger. But I don't know, if someone does, like, a giant movie and then does a small indie film after that, it's probably because that giant movie was really, really hard on them, just, like, creatively, you know?
Right. No. And I, having been in the hot seat before, it's not really demoralizing so much as because I think that ultimately filmmakers, you know, nobody, I don't think anybody thinks that they're going to be a millionaire becoming a filmmaker.
Yeah, I really hope they don't.
Yeah, right. That's such a wake up call. But yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I think that ultimately filmmakers want to be artists.
Yes.
And to finally go up against that, like, corporate machine, either you really respond well to it. Like, I think, like, YTT is an example of somebody who's just, like, he just gets the game, right?
Joseph Kahn, too.
Yeah.
A lot of commercials that are just, like, insanely well done, you know?
Yeah. Or, you know, you're more, I think, than the majority of filmmakers, which is like you have to just make concessions inside of like your thought process. Right. Like this is not, you're not making a movie. Your name is going on it as the creator. But, you know, and good luck, because you're not making the choices as the creator, you know.
Yeah.
The person that owns the IP, the person that financed the movie, the people that are going to distribute it, like they all have their opinions, and they're all people that want their opinions to matter to ultimately make the best product. Right.
Yeah. But
that is ultimately not like they're not going to no one's going to blame DC. Right, for not delivering on the Justice League. They're going to blame either Joss Whedon, who came in late, or Zack Snyder, who was there at the beginning, whatever. Like,
yeah, I mean that whole situation is really weird. I'm going to be honest, but it's a rough
industry where you're blamed for stuff that you shouldn't be blamed for.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah, no, like, yeah, I think that the fans of these things who tweet at companies and comment on things. And, you know, I think that like sometimes they, and it's not that they're like uneducated, but like sometimes they misunderstand, like they think that there's like one person in the driver's seat, you know, and there's just not. And it's, and
not
there's,
even
it's,
yeah, sorry.
Yeah. I was just saying it's gotta be really tough to be the person that gets blamed for that kind of thing, because like, there's literally, I mean, you see the credits of these things, man. It's thousands of people work on these movies. Thousands. And there are more that aren't even credited that are like at, oh, they were like the development person, or oh, they were like the brand person. They're not even in the credits. You know, it's like, it's so big. I honestly, I a while ago stopped putting too much hope in like giant movies. And when I say giant, I mean anything over like $50 million, you know. There's a certain point where I just was like, you know, I'll go see these with friends and they're cool. And if I really like, if I, you know, if I have an Endgame experience, like great, you know, but they're just so big. It's really hard to put much hope in something that inherently is incredibly complicated. And I, you know, I've worked at bigger companies that so many cooks in the kitchen to just to get like a 15-second Instagram ad out. And these were at, you know, 300 person companies. I can't imagine what it's like being at a multi-level, you know, 500 person, 800 person company. I mean, I don't know, man. It kind of, I don't know. It, to me, I actually like staying in the smaller space, and it's why I like web a lot. And it's why I like doing, Instagram ads and Facebook ads, is because you don't have to run anything by the like FCC or you don't have to. It's just like such a simpler. I mean, I could right now make a video and pay to promote it on people's Facebook pages, you know, and like it's a lot less regulation in that sense, which is bad for fake news, but good for creators.
No. I don't. Obviously, they can. It's an angle that can be used for evil, like everything. But yes, in terms of artists, like yes, it would. It's fantastic. The thing I don't like is what would you call it? The proliferation of entertainment has made it so that that you need kind of lightning rods like Netflix. Like, I mean, is Facebook still making content?
I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, Apple is now, right? And
Apple's, yeah.
Yeah, I do think that we do need like a focusing aspect of entertainment so that we can all enjoy stuff, right?
No, you keep going. I was going to say how often have you tried to bring up a show and like people don't even heard of it or know what it's on?
Mrs. America, honestly.
Is that on Hulu?
Yes.
Okay. I just guessed.
Yeah. No. It's on Hulu. It was it's Kate Blanchett. Incredible cast. It's phenomenal, and it's so topical because it's basically about how the political machine initially got hijacked by the Republican Party during just before the Carter years, you know, and how they weaponized media. And I mean, it kind of highlights how the reason why the, you know, let's call it the liberal or democratic left, the reason why they couldn't do it is because they're crippled both by this like desire to be morally correct, but fractured as to what can be considered morally correct.
You know, that sounds insanely topical.
It's so topical. And I mean, there's this whole thing in the beginning about how the feminist movement initially didn't want to recognize the, you know, the, basically their lesbian members, because lesbianism is, you know, well, to some people is too fractious. Like, we'll never get anybody who's religious to be on board with us versus it's anyway, I highly recommend it.
It sounds dope.
But I would say that, you know, when I bring it up to people, they don't, you know, they don't know about it. They've never heard of it.
Right.
And I do think that that is the, if we keep going in that direction where there's, where everybody has, every single distributor has their own platform, right? It's just too many subscriptions, right? You're going to be spending $1,000 a month trying to keep track of it all.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I love the stuff that I've been doing for HBO Max, but every time I talk to somebody about it, there is confusion. I mean, there is like, wait, do I have that already? I already have HBO. It's, you know, they actually had to make an explainer video about it. Because there's so much.
Disney Plus went through a similar thing, right? Like,
yeah.
Have you seen The Mandalorian? Whoa, no, I haven't. Oh, it's on Disney Plus. Cool. Is there anything else on Disney Plus? Yeah, like some other Disney stuff. Oh, okay. And then most people, at least, once again, this is through the eye of the beholder, right? There's no statistics here. It's an opinion that I have. Most people, including myself, borrowed somebody else's account.
Sure.
To watch Mandalorian and then didn't stick around. And it seems like what HBO Max is doing, judging by what you're saying, is that they're just putting it all up there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so biased, but like, I do think their marketing's cool because it is like, if you look at their ads, it's like showing a huge variety of stuff. Mm-hmm. And that I think is ultimately what people want from like a service is, like I said at the beginning, like you want people who are just gonna watch Friends, but then you also want people who are like, I think people like you and me who are like, yo, Chernobyl was cool, what else you got? You know, right. Is that's ultimately what a really successful service will have, is they'll have both. They'll have like something for people who want nostalgia and comfort viewing, and then something for people who, you know, want something kind of edgier and darker and has, you know, interesting questions and stuff like that. But, you know, sometimes that's the same person, but oftentimes like those are really different viewers, you know?
Yeah, no, I think that Netflix did it best when they acquired, and I brought this up before, when they acquired Longmire. Because Longmire was a show where I think its target demographic was something like men in their late 30s to early 70s, right? Like, just not a target demographic really by anybody. But
it's very outside what marketing agencies obsess over. Yeah.
Exactly, right? Except but Netflix saw an opportunity.
Yeah.
And, you know, I will say, as an aging out male, I don't share my Netflix account anymore with my like parents or something, right? So I can only imagine what a 50-year-old is not going to ask me like, hey, can I borrow your Netflix account? They'll just get the Netflix account, right?
So that's interesting. Okay.
Yeah. I think that their subscription, this is a couple of years ago, but their subscription base like jumped by 2% because of Longmire, because it was getting canceled because they wanted to do, I forget, it was maybe TNT or something like that. And they wanted to do something young and edgier and, you know, more explosions and they were giving it up. So it's fascinating how the streaming service can really, the streaming services can give every single demographic exactly what they want.
Yeah.
Or at least a spectrum of what they want.
Yeah, that's kind of the name of the game, and recognizing, you know, and a lot of this too just falls on the kinds of shows that get greenlit, but, you know, recognizing demographics that haven't really had a show for them yet. you know, I mean, that's a huge thing. I mean, I think Netflix and HBO are very, very good at that. At like, hey, here's a show for, you know, a part of the population that really hasn't gotten a lot of stories told about them.
Right. And ultimately, I mean, and it's funny because this goes back to what we were initially talking about. Ultimately, that's being motivated by money, right? Getting more money.
It is. But that's when it's like using the powers for good, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's, I think that's one of the reasons why you don't have a, I mean, at least that I'm not aware of, I don't think you have a foreign streaming service that's competing with any of the American based companies.
Yeah. If there is, I don't know of it.
I think Red Letter over in the Norwegian, you know, countries has some kind of streaming service, but you know, they're making Nordic Entertainment. You know, mm-hmm. And Nordic Entertainment is probably not going to have very much in common with Mexican entertainment, you know, or South American entertainment. But, you know, I know that Netflix greenlit a show that's bilingual, you know, Narcos, yeah. You saw it. And Narcos is amazing.
Well, you know? and they push stuff. I mean, like Money Heist, you know, I mean, they've pushed a lot of foreign language shows pretty right. hard, and they've put them right up there with the like English shows, which is kind of cool. It's kind of interesting. Never really seen a company do that.
Yeah, I will say I don't like it when I've never heard of a show and I'm super intrigued, and I'll start it and I'll start noticing like no one said anything out loud for like the first 3 minutes of the movie. I bet this is a, you know, dubbed show or foreign language show, and it's like, ah, you got me, you know.
Yeah, you got me. I was but like. Kind of cool that they got you. I don't know.
I would prefer reading subtitles though over dubbed stuff. I can't do dubbed.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Especially with live action, it's tough.
Yeah.
Because animation, you can kind of fake the lip flap, but live right. action, no way.
I mean, Studio Ghibli gets it professionally done, right? Like they hire an all-star cast.
Yeah, yeah. 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 Ghibli's dubs are great. Yeah.
Yeah. No, they're fantastic. But it's when it's, there's something about seeing or hearing words coming out of someone's mouth and they're not it's not correct, and yeah. it just gets underneath my skin and I can't watch it, but I'll do subtitles.
Yeah, subtitles. I'm always down for subtitles. I actually feel like I pay way more attention with subtitles just because like
you do, yeah.
You can't. I mean, I can't look at my phone during right. a film with subs. There's just there's no way. And sometimes I've done that and then I'm like, oh wait, and then I have to like backtrack it because I missed it, you know. Whereas like films in English, TV shows in English, there's definitely a couple things I've missed because I've like zoned out, you know. And that's
that's natural. That's one of the reasons why I prefer going to the movie theaters, because you're dedicating yourself to 2.5-3 hours to an experience, unless you're that guy that takes his phone out during a movie, which
we don't have to talk about that guy. That guy, yeah.
I try to like that guy, but I mean, it's definitely, you know, pushing the envelope on what I can handle.
I try to empathize with that guy, but yeah, it's tough.
Maybe his mom's in the hospital or...
Yeah, there's always something.
Yeah.
Yeah, something. I get it.
But, you know, she'll still be in the hospital if you just keep your goddamn phone in your pocket and you can deal with it when she leaves.
Yeah. Also, like, if I'm really like going through something that is requiring my attention 24/7, I generally don't go to the movies. I don't know about you, but I just like, yeah. I'm like, I can't just like turn my phone off for 2 hours. Like I'm in the middle of, you know, I don't know. Maybe that's just me.
No, I am in complete agreement. and plus, I married a woman who is a cinematographer, and
right.
If, oh my God, if my phone, like she just turns and looks at me at the beginning of every movie, it's like, you turned your phone off, right?
Well, Bowman, you got to understand, if that phone is brighter than the screen, it's got more lumens. And right. So inherently, you're going to be messing up the contrast ratio that was intended.
Right, right. Which, what was the point of even going to the movies if you were just going to ruin the thing that this guy slaved over for the last 2 years of his life? Yeah, no, I've
you know, the thing is, I really identify with her on that. In many ways, yeah, as somebody who really cares about the finishing process.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Yeah, I have on several notable occasions forgotten that my phone is on, and man, is it just...
Have you ever complained about something with like the projection or sound at a movie theater? Because I've definitely done this a number of times.
What, like leave the movie theater and complain yes. about during the movie? Not during the movie, because I feel like I will then have missed something, right?
Okay.
But I have complained afterward, and it's never been sound.
Yeah, because I've seen stuff where they, like, it's a surround mix, and there's, you know, six speakers, and, like, the center channel, like, the center speaker's off, so, like, there's no dialogue. Right. And, like, I've complained about that. I saw Little Women, and they presented it in the wrong aspect ratio. It was, you know, that movie's,
Is this at Arclight or
this was at a Regal. And yeah, I mean that movie's 1.85 and they cropped it. Ooh. And so you had a lot of close-ups where like you literally couldn't see people's eyes. And you I went and said something 3 times. I was like, yo, this is off. But like what's so funny is no one knew how to fix it. There was no one on staff that could fix it. I offered to fix it, which you know, say what you want about that. And then at the end of the movie, everyone loved it and everyone clapped and nobody noticed. And that's the part that was like, huh, you guys just thought that was like a choice that we're only framing the nose and the mouth instead of the eyes.
I mean, look, this goes back to like people that have that buy their TV, plug it in and just start watching, but it's got that dynamic motion on.
Oh, yeah.
And I cannot watch anything with dynamic motion. I become motion sick.
Yeah, well, it's meant for live sports. Yeah.
Sure, but like my sister-in-law, she loves it, you know.
Right.
And, I was taking care of her kids for the weekend at their house because they had to go and have another baby. I couldn't understand how they could have how their eyes could adjust to this. You know?
Yeah, I've definitely like been the guy at people's houses who's like, can I just have the remote for just like 5 minutes? Can we just mess with the settings. I've definitely been that person. But, you know, it doesn't come from wanting to be annoying. It really doesn't. It actually just comes from like wanting to watch stuff and hear stuff in the way like as close to like what was intended as possible.
Right.
But yeah, it's such a tough balance with that because you like. You're obviously like very passionate about it. You're like, let me just fix it. It'll take me 5 minutes. And then there's that element of like, this is like annoying and slowing down our night. And yeah.
It's... Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I've been in quarantine for too long, but I have no patience for that stuff anymore. Like you should not be ingesting things that are bad. you need to, you know, stop. This is not good for you. but I guess everybody's coming at it the last couple months, you know, with all sorts of dirt. I definitely used to put up with those kinds of things. But now I'm looking for, you know, I'm really hopeful for the next like Game of Thrones experience that has people come together and want to watch something over the course of, you know, I love that. You know, I love the community aspect. I love the, I'm really looking forward to that again. But if I go over to someone's house and they have dynamic range on, I'm going to be the guy that goes, this is not for us.
You should offer to fix it. That's what
I will. I will. Oh, I'll thank you fondly.
But that's why I love live music and stand up so much too, is just, I mean, that's been the hard part about this whole period is obviously I've learned a lot about myself and been very introspective and, creatively, it's been amazing, but I do seriously miss just like seeing something with a crowd. Like, I miss the crowd part. I miss laughing at or a movie as a group. You know, I mean that stuff's really special to me.
Yeah.
And it's tough. It's tough without it. It's really tough without it. And a lot of art's changed.
I have found that my once a week trip to the grocery store is now. Like I try to be as jovial and, you know, abiding as possible to everyone. And, you know, there was a woman that just started talking to me. And I've noticed this in other people as well. She just started like, oh, you're in the barbecue section. And it's like, I'm not aware of what aisle I'm in, but sure. Right.
You're very easy to talk to.
Yeah. Yeah. to the annoyance of some.
Sure. I think that's like, more about you, though.
You know, if you want a good barbecue sauce, I would recommend this. And I just was feeling of the mind, and I was like, sure, fine, yes, I'll do it. She goes, wait, really? And I'm like, yeah, I'll buy this barbecue sauce. This is the best barbecue sauce in the world. She's like, well, I mean, some people think so. I was like, no, you said it was the best in the world, so I'm buying it now. And she ended up coming back and was like, look, if you don't like it, maybe they'll let you return it. I don't want you to be mad at me. And I'm like, no. You know, so like, sweet. but I do, I, you know, that's how much I miss people that yeah. I just, you know, I'm down now for a lot.
Yeah, no, me too. I'm excited to, yeah, like have any kind of communal artistic thing, you know, whether it's a live show or even to go to a movie again. Yeah, obviously, when it's the thing safe, I miss, but yeah.
The yeah.
Yeah, going to movies. I mean, I used to just go, God, I can walk to a movie theater. I'm literally a block from one. And so I just go all the time. I mean, it's great. And I would try to see stand up. I try to see like some live thing once a month, whether it was a show or stand up, just because like, mm-hmm. I think it's important. I think it's really important to remind yourself that you're like in a city with people. And it's like you're not in like a silo, because I think that like it's really easy even before COVID to like just kind of like it's just me and my single player game I'm playing and that's it, you know.
Yep. No. I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah.
I've never, having grown up in New York City,
right,
and then coming out here, like I've never experienced, like I do not know what it would be like to be by myself forcibly for 3 months. Mm. You know, I'm lucky that I have, you know, my wife. I'm lucky that my neighbor and I are, you know, Brendan and I are very, you know, close. Mm-hmm. And he's got asthma, so he's been taking it even more seriously. Sure. But it's one of those things that I can't imagine what you must be going through, you know.
Yeah, I live alone. Yeah, so yeah. It's I legit do not see people for long, long stretches of time. And I don't even mean like, oh, I don't see friends. Like, no, I don't see like
people. Human beings.
Like, yeah. I don't interact, like the person I interact with is like the cashier at, you know,
right,
the supermarket for 10 minutes. I mean, it's like, it's super isolating. So, online games have been great. You know, phone calls with friends, with people like you has been great. And then when I do see, you know, like I saw my dad like a couple weeks ago and like, right. I don't know if this is oversharing, but I was just like really emotional because I was like, yep. Oh my God, like it's a person. And like, I gave him a hug and like that hug meant a lot to me because it was like, I realized I hadn't hugged someone in 2 months. And that was like a super weird feeling.
No, that's not oversharing. And I felt the same thing. I mean, my parents, you know, they're down in Venice and it's, you know, it was really awesome to see them once they finally said like, okay, you know, if you've gone through like a month and a half of like, you can start like slowly seeing people. But it was oddly enough, it was seeing my friend Andrew Davies, who's a producer, who's somebody, you know, he's one of those people, like I work with him. And then we kind of go through long stretches of time until we work together again, you know, and
sure.
And,
yeah.
And he's just had a baby and, you know, asking, I was saying like, oh, well, I'll see you at the same supermarket. And seeing him was just like super like, yeah, you get like a little emotional, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I can imagine that, like, I mean, maybe we're not going to be able to do it because, well, we're opening up before, like, you know, the scientists have told us we should open up. And
it's another podcast, but yeah.
Yeah. And you know, and we're really divided right now as a culture, but like, I'm really hoping that at least in the city of Los Angeles, like when I go to the first movie theater, I kind of, you know, I'm really pumped at the idea that we're all going to enjoy this movie together, you know? And I don't know.
Oh dude, like it's going to be, I feel like concerts after this are going to be so like electric, you know, when they can happen again safely and it's not too early and all that. I'm very much on that side of things. Like, let's wait. It's fine. But when we can go to like a music event as a group. I mean, dude, that like, whew, is going to be awesome. People, it's gonna, right. That's going to mean so much to like rock out. Oh, it's going to be great, you know?
Yeah. And I really do want it to be safe though, you know? Yes. So I don't want to rush it. Obviously I want it, but I don't, because the exact opposite will end up happening, you know, is that if we do go back and everybody's super happy to be in, you know, enjoying a movie together, enjoying a comedy special together or whatever, and then a week later, everybody that went is sick, it's going to, you know, everyone, it'll make this last 3 months not mean anything. And and everything will just go dark, you know, be really, really, you know, sad.
It'll be a second quarantine. Yeah. No, I'm very much on the side. And this is generally how I've lived most of my life, is I'd rather wait a little bit longer for like the good option as opposed to like, let's just get it right now. I've never subscribed to that philosophy in anything I do. I'm patience goes a long way, especially in a pandemic.
Well, I think that's an excellent place to end our talk, and I'll give you the that's a good last word to get in, and it's very positive. And I'm hoping that I hope I get to see you in the flesh sooner rather than later. You could always come up to, or I could come down to a supermarket, and when we could play it safe together there. But I don't know.
I'm down. Yeah, sure. Yeah. I got to buy food up sometimes. Yeah.
At some point, right?
Yeah.
All right, man. Well, good talking to you.
Yeah, I was going to say this has been really, really great. And, you know, you've had a lot of incredibly intelligent people on the show. And I'm very honored that you asked me to do it. It's super fun.
Well, you can definitely tell. You can definitely wear the accolade of being incredibly intelligent. I think you're one of the smartest people I know.
Aw, Bowman. Well, thank you, man. I hope you have a really lovely day, bud.
All right, man.
So that was... it's kind of a bro fest, I guess. As you can tell, I have a lot of respect for Mr. Boyer. I just realized, you know, on reflection of going through this, through the edit, I didn't realize we went on such a tear of just talking about the streaming industry. And this episode took place a couple months ago, and now. You know, we did open too soon. America kind of stands alone as one of the, I mean, we have the leading number of deaths every day. Thousands of people have died. I believe we're over 100,000 now at this point, and kind of stopped keeping track. It's kind of like a listening to a little bit of like a time capsule or something. And I guess just to update everybody, it is now, you know, Jeff Bezos, I think they made like $42 billion over the course of this hour that you've been listening. It's all been confirmed that he's going to be a trillionaire. Amazon is now regarded as one of the most important industries in the country. Not that it really, I'm sure it doesn't really matter that much. This pandemic has really kind of just emphasized how much the upper class and the business class is really benefiting from all of these bailouts that are kind of happening left and right. Meanwhile, as of right now, I think we're 3 days into it. There is no stimulus, so that extra $600 a week is no longer happening. And they're telling us just to kind of get back to work. The industry is kind of waking up, but I think everybody's scared. So that being said, I don't know what you do, but I hope that your industry is taking the right steps as we prematurely open and force normalcy onto our society. Hopefully we can be like Sweden, which seems to have, after a horrendous death toll, has managed to flatten the curve finally. But who knows? I will be here twiddling my thumbs and working on all of the different projects that I have come across my way, getting painting done, and of course, coming back to doing more Enclave. If you'd like to be a guest on the show, please message me. Be sure to subscribe, follow, share. I really do appreciate it. I just love this. I love the opportunity to talk to good people so much. Thank you again.